Hey, thanks for listening to the Petapixel podcast. Catch new episodes every week on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Petapixel podcast. It's me, Chris Nichols, your host for today, joined by my two other hosts for today, as usual, Jordan Drake and Jaren Schneider.
Hey, I like to do the intro, so I'm just, I think I'm just going to take it right now. Yeah, that's Jaren over there, too. We love Jaren. Hi, Jaren.
Hi.
Guys... No, this is going to become my thing. I like doing the intros, and I've prepped questions, so I'm not going to let you just start this show like that. Hey, everybody. It's a Petapixel podcast where we talk about like photo and video stuff. And today, I want to know, some of you might be curious about our personalities, so I like to start things off with a question, and we're going to be talking movies today. You know, it's right before, this is going to drop right before the Oscars. Hopefully people have seen a lot of those award-winning movies. We're talking movies today, so I want to know you two, what is, if you go to the movie theater, your default order for food and drink?
Oh.
So there was, I don't know. First, Chris, you had to think last time, so I'm going to make you think longer. This
go
time
for it. Go first. You.
There is a place in, I haven't gone to the movies in a while when I actually ordered food. Usually I'll just go and I'll just watch. But the last time I ordered food, they had samosas. So that's what I I actually don't like popcorn. Not because I don't like how it tastes. I just don't like that it gets stuck in my teeth. That's like, I don't eat regular corn either, like on the cob. I just avoid anything that gets in there. But samosas, if they're available, I'm getting
them. That's brilliant. I think this is one of the great things that's happened in the last 10 years is actual food at movie theaters.
Yeah, not just hot dogs and popcorn and candy.
You guys are monsters.
Well, what about those?
What's yours, Chris?
Like the little ice cream things, too. They're what are they called?
Oh, the dots?
They're not dots, but they're like the little the chocolate-covered bite-sized pieces of...
No, you guys are walking travesties. That's terrible. I mean, you're supposed to go with the... You're walking travesties. It's horrible. You're an affront to the movie and cinema industry, both of you. Food now, it's too easy. Like, now you got to sit and watch a movie and you got like some smelly fast food sitting right next to you and people have like coffees and bubble teas and it's just ridiculous. Like, it should be a classic fountain pop. It should be classic popcorn, but layered. You got to layer. You got to get the butter all the way through there, preferably real butter. Come on. And then like an old school kind of candy like Junior Mints or M&Ms or Twizzlers.
Junior
like,
Mints. Has anyone eaten a Junior Mint?
I like Junior Mints, so I'll get on board with the Junior Mints.
There you go. Yeah,
have you purchased a Junior Mint or will you accept a Junior Mint if one is offered to you?
The latter.
Because I'll take a Junior Mint.
I would never buy them myself. No, but no. It's a staple. And we're talking about the movie theater being a temple, and you don't just go and tread all over tradition like that. So, on that note,
one of the last commercial gigs I ever shot was for Guy Fieri. He hired us to do a commercial. Well, it's not even him. It was his production crew hired us to do a commercial for his movie theater he was opening in Dubai, where it was also his restaurant. So you would watch movies and they would bring you Guy Fieri themed food. And Guy's a great guy, but that was not an intentional words. He's a really good person, really nice guy, actually nice in person, but his food is like not really necessarily my thing. It's always kind of over the top. Ostentatious. No. So if you're saying that there's an affront to the temple that is the movie theater, I think that would probably be the largest.
In Dubai is... Yeah,
the and yet all the theaters are trying to go that way.
Yeah, well, because, I want alcohol now. I like that idea. I like being able to drink. And
yeah, but alcohol makes people get all talky talk and there's nothing worse. I mean, again, that's another crime, right? Is talking during the movie is an absolute affront, right? We got to deal with cell phones now and cell phone lights.
Like last week on the pod. Yeah.
People, just horrible. So I'm team old school. Anyways, what about you, Jordan?
So I am also not a popcorn person, Jaren. What? I mean, if it's I'll snack on it. But a movie theater is one of the only places I'll eat a hot dog. I'm not a hot dog person. But
it was going to be on my
hot
list.
Hot dog in a movie theater.
I like hot dogs too. They're good in there. Yeah.
But I gotta say, like, my all-time greatest was when I went and saw a movie for the first time after the pandemic. Went and saw Spielberg's West Side Story by myself. There were three people in the movie theater. Amazing night. Such a great movie. I got myself a spicy chicken sandwich because they were doing, like, the good food and a can of red wine. And I gotta tell you guys, one of the great nights of my life. And I told my wife about this, and she, like, almost gagged.
Red wine. That is for streaming at home.
Yeah.
That is for sure. You want it? The new movie theater is streaming at home. That's what you do at home. Anyways, you guys are both horrible. If I had to sit next to you guys in a movie theater and I needed a camera because I'm going to legally record the movie and sell it, and I want it to survive all of your ketchup and your mustard and your hot dog and your canned red wine, I would go with the OM system, TG7, the Tough. I mean, it is designed to even emotionally handle the travesty that you guys are committing to our story.
Is this your best segue?
Yes, it is. Anyways.
Considering that we haven't even gone to our title screen yet, you're like jumping ahead. I'm going to force us to come back to this after our title screen. You've just given people a preview of the current thing, the sponsor of this episode.
Perfect.
Give it a second. Deep breaths. We'll get there. Hold on.
Okay, anyways, where was I? So the ad read. So our podcast, we're very thankful to OM System for being a sponsor of our podcast. We're proud to have them. The TG7, I mean, this is an award-winning compact camera that's designed for rugged environments. It is built like a tank, except it doesn't have an engine, but everything else, it's fantastic. Waterproof, shockproof, freeze-proof, crush-proof. I mean, I love this camera for hiking the mountains. I like it for fly fishing, obviously. It's great for skiing. It's great for any sort of beach use. You know, it's also a really nice camera just to give to young children to let them explore and take photography and not have to worry about them damaging or breaking it. You can drop this thing from 7 feet, which it'll totally survive me because I'm not that tall. It'll withstand pressures up to 220 pounds. I'm not there yet, so I could even stand on it without breaking it. And it will take bone chilling temperatures down to -10 Celsius, which, I mean, we get here in Alberta all the time. I love the seals, double locks. I mean, I've used these personally quite a few models. I've personally never had one fail. And again, it's great for underwater shots. It's great for in the shower, having fun time with the spouse. And you can even get a special housing for it if you want, where you can autoclave this sucker.
Yeah, this is something I wanted to bring up. I added this note in here. So like last July, before the TG7 was actually announced, it was still the TG6, OM System brought out this autoclavable, like super case for it for use in the medical field, which I think is super neat. If you don't know what autoclaving is, it's like high temperature steam cleaning. So you put this thing in like a mega oven and it heats it to like 250 degrees Fahrenheit and just like super cleans it. So that's how you sterilize stuff in the medical field. Anyway, it's perfect. That's super cool.
So if you need a camera that's going to be like in an industry where you're photographing and videotaping things where there's like lots of bodily fluids and like really close up kind of stuff and like various different people's, you know, stuff, then this is a camera you could sterilize afterwards. It's great. Really, so if you want durability, reliability, you know, and pocketability, this is a great camera. Look at the OM System Tough TG7. Professionals can use it. Casual parents can use it. Family members, kids. It's great for anybody who likes active
casual parents.
Stuff.
Like you're not that committed.
Yeah, I know. Because if you're really committed, you're probably doing something other than letting your kids
run off the rails so early today.
No, but seriously, the TG7, I mean, we have to also recognize, like, when point and shoot cameras in this industry have been disappearing, and that's been going by the wayside because of phones, the TG7 is still there. It's been going strong because it's still a very useful product. Recognized as one of the top digital cameras for 2024 by such prestigious outfits as NBC News, PC Mag, Wirecutter, Digital Camera World, and we even like it here at Petapixel. It's got cutting-edge technology, rugged construction, saves your memories, stunning detail, no matter where you want to photograph. So, big thing, March 31st, until March 31st, you will save $50 off the purchase of an OM system, Tough TG7. So this is a great time to do it. So go to an authorized OM system retailer or go to explore.omsystem.com/petapixel. As always, that's our link and you can get great deals there. Don't miss out on your chance to get the extraordinary TG7.
I'm going to put that on the board as one of the great ad reads you've ever done, Chris.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it was already a pretty long one and you made it longer. Which yes. is very impressive. Like, you added a lot in there that was not in the read. So,
yeah, it's because OM System promised me a free TG7 to
That's not how it works.
Oh, damn. Not, I'm not getting one?
Don't give people the idea that that's, what, that, oh, that's a crap. Thing. Because people will believe that it's true when you say it and not
luckily,
sense
I already
that you're
have
joking
one.
Around.
I already have one, which I bought with my hard-earned cash already. It's sitting around here somewhere. So, great camera.
All right. Well... before we get into movies, and the way that Jordan wanted to do this was to, you know, like the pre-Oscar thing, but I also wanted to frame it as like the best movies in the last year that will help inspire you to be a better creator.
Ooh.
Yes, before we want to talk cinematography.
Yes.
I have a sub art for that, so absolutely. Inspiring so, and great films.
Before we get to that, though, there's a few things that happened in the last week that we should talk about. The first one is that we all kind of collaborated on this. I picked their brains. There was an opinion that hit the blogosphere. I haven't used that word in a really long time. That was fun.
Ooh.
Last week, that was basically saying that if it's not a full frame camera that you own, then your camera sucks. It's bad, and you should feel bad.
Yeah.
We took the opposite stance that you need to stop being so elitist about the size of your sensor. So I wanted to leave you a chance to come in here, Jordan, because you were, Chris maybe has something to say too, but Jordan was texting me on Friday, like, when are you publishing that? So I published it on Sunday. I haven't talked to him since. I want to hear
that rebuttal out there. And we should say, I don't know how clicks were on it, but feedback in terms of comments on that was huge on the website as well. But yeah, I do think it's a very silly perspective. I mean, there's been different formats throughout the history of photography. And the big thing I wanted to get across is, yes, if you're looking, you know, for image quality, I think full frame is a real sweet spot right now in terms of price to performance. But if you scale down your sensor size, you'll often get access to other features that you're not going to see on a full frame until you get to a very high premium price. And the example I used is a stacked sensor. You know, you can spend $2,000, get an OM1, Micro Four Thirds, $2,500 for an APS-C XH2S, or your starting point is really $4,000 for an Nikon Z8 if you want a full frame with a stacked sensor. Yeah. So you pay a premium for those features, which might be really important to the type of work that you're doing.
But you know, this article went more off the rails than my ad read as well, because it went beyond just sensor size. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, the best sensor size is full frame for most people. I wouldn't even disagree with that. But you know, the author was also claiming things like certain brands, which just happen to be limited to Micro Four Thirds, also have poor color. For example, Panasonic, which I totally disagree. I mean, first off, it's wildly subjective what color is good or not. easy to edit and manipulate and change. And honestly, I think Panasonic have incredibly accurate, very realistic colors out of the gate in the get-go. And honestly, the whole color debate's ridiculous because everybody has a different opinion about it. It was a strange article. It came across very much like an opinion piece, but also almost like it was hungry for controversy and fishing for comments and engagement that way. And I get it. And I mean, that is a tactic. That is a strategy that can work in the journalistic world. I just don't know if it's necessarily a healthy one, especially for an industry like photography.
Okay.
Jaron?
Yeah. No, I mean, I wrote the majority of that piece. And for me, it was just like, it's just so silly to get elitist about that. Like, I keep talking about it because I had a really good experience and I continue to have a really good experience, but I'm using the X106 and it's
enough about the X106.
But like one of the major complaints, 35 millimeter, one of the major complaints in that opinion piece that we were referring to in our rebuttal is that they said that like even the build quality of APS-C in smaller cameras is like markedly worse than full frame. I don't know, man. The build quality of this one, I'm just holding it right now, is fabulous.
Feels great.
The G9 II, amazing.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, it was easy to point to other cameras. And it's like, but that doesn't mean that all full frame cameras feel great. Like the RP, no. for example.
And you have terrible. To allow for different
There's
price
points. There's a ZV-E1 over there that just makes my hand sad every time I touch it.
Yeah. You got to allow for different budgets. You got to allow for different price points. You know, every engineer is going to have a different outcome for what, how rugged the camera has to be, how heavy it should be, all that kind of stuff. What materials you choose to make it out of. I mean, there's levels of prestige and there's levels of build quality. And I think that's still totally fair to say like, oh, we should just be doing full frame cameras. You can get cheaper full frame cameras that would be better than any APS-C. I mean, you know, then you're talking purely in robotic, pragmatic terms. You're not thinking about the look, the feel, the experience of shooting it. You know, the enjoyment of cameras that have different capabilities and different intentions. I mean, like the X100-6 is a good example, right? I mean, that's not a practical camera for all photography, right? It's a purpose built, specially designed camera. Why wouldn't there be a place for that? Like, it was just a really silly article. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure what the goal was other than to get engagement.
Well, yeah. I'm glad I got to hear your actual words on this because we were only communicating about it over email last week. And so there you go. All right, moving on. Enough of that. Let's talk about a really popular lens today. And it's one that you can't even get yet. It's just all pre-orders. And you guys liked it. Sigma's 500mm f5.6 is
love
now
that lens.
Among the most popular from Sigma. And they're saying that they're expecting to have issues fulfilling demand. Now, this is not
I'm
an
assuming
unusual
it's-
statement.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's entirely our review, and we apologize to Kazuto-san specifically for
it's just those wolf dogs
ramping
look
up.
So good,
they're great dogs. Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful lens, and it's a lens that not only is optically fantastic, but also, as we mentioned in the video review, like there's not a lot of choice in that realm with that mount. So it fills a niche that's very important to fill. I think a lot of people are realizing they don't necessarily need 2.8 or F4 glass to get good shots, especially with modern cameras and how good they are with higher ISOs. So if I was a wildlife photographer, even a very high level professional one, I would personally probably still in a lot of cases be perfectly fine with a slower, easier to carry lens for situations where you do want to hike or backpack or travel. And I mean, this is just, yeah, it's yummy. It's yumminess.
Yeah, yummy. And there's no need to stop down for sharpness,
no.
right? Like, that's the great thing there. Just always shoot at 5.6 all day long unless you want more depth of field. But that's generally not the case on a super telephoto. So, yeah, that lens rules.
This is just your alert. If you were interested in this lens and wanted to get one, I'm not trying to advocate, you know, go buy consumerism. But, like, if you really want this lens, you should probably get on the list now because we don't know how long it's going to take for them to actually fulfill the orders that are currently in. So, just
man, can you imagine if it was available for Z mount and RF mount? Oh, man. Oh,
yeah, I don't really know why it's not available for Nikon's mount. There doesn't seem to be a particular reason. Maybe it's because Nikon has a bunch of other lenses in that range, but they don't have a 500.
I suspect 5.6. That's it. I almost wonder if they're letting Sigma do stuff in a case-by-case basis where it's not butting up against their lenses, and they do have the 600 f6.3, which is again,
it was
a stunning
lens.
Very close to that.
Yeah. Okay, but it's way more expensive, is it not?
It is way more expensive, twice the price.
Okay, next story. This came about during an interview with Canon, and it is that Canon believes that there is no single camera on the market right now that is high res enough that can refresh fast enough to make content look good in an Apple Vision Pro. And I think something that I really need to clarify on this, and I probably should have done a better job in the story, is that they're speaking single camera. You can get dual camera systems and shoot side by side for each eye. But Canon's strategy for VR has been one camera with a dual lens. So that was like, that's what they have right now. It's a 5.2mm f2.8L. It's the weird looking.
Yeah, in our app mount,
Yeah. That's what they're saying. And they actually also don't seem to think that lens is going to be good enough either. They're like, if we're going to do this, we have to make another one of these lenses and also a better camera to put it on. So that's the argument. They think it's going to take 100 megapixels that can refresh at 60 frames per second in order to make a single camera unit capable of generating content for this headset. And that translates to 14K, which is a lot of Ks. And I don't they basically they said we're thinking that we should probably consider this a quote business opportunity, which, you know, very, very true. Maybe they should. What are you guys' thoughts? Do you think that it is feasible to shoot with a single camera with a dual lens when you're shooting for VR, which is becoming a bigger thing? Or
absolutely,
do you think it should be always a dual camera system?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't, I think we're a ways off from being able to do this with a single sensor. Like, that's really the, yeah, sure, it sounds great. And you do have two 8K screens sitting side by side. It makes sense that you're going to need, you know, around, because 8K is about 45 megapixels. So right around that 100 megapixel mark. Absolutely, to get the most out of that. It's just, yeah, it's not, you're not going to get a sensor that can shoot that high res at 60 frames per second and not completely cook. so we're just a ways out on it. I mean, we do have, there's a Blackmagic 12K camera that we've actually reviewed available on that. But, you know, it's Super 35 and it was a good light only kind of camera. And I don't believe, I believe it was capped at 30 frames per second when you were recording 12K was as high as you could get. So it's just not there yet.
Oh, I bet the rolling shutter is going to suck too on the early sensors. It's going to be brutal. The scan speeds will be slow. Everybody's going to be vomiting in their Apple Vision Pros. Oh, it's going to be just terrible.
Yeah.
So you're an advocate of the dual camera. Side by side.
I think that's what we have to do for the time being. You know, eventually.
Do you
we might
think
get
we
there.
Should have a single camera solution?
I mean, there's the big thing is it is so difficult to deal with the inconsistencies once you start doing actual filmmaking of a dual camera setup, you know, like pulling focus and things like that. Even like your glass will have slightly different color on it. Mm. You know, breathing characteristics, if they're not aligned perfectly, you're going to get weirdness. Like it is a huge pain to shoot dual system, no question. So yeah, we're at the point where it's like, do you want to deal with something incredibly cumbersome or wait for something where the technology doesn't exist?
So I guess here's
where we're at.
Here's a question I want to expand on that is like, do you guys think that this will even stick? Not the Vision Pro, but you know, what are the applications we're talking about? One would be to do cinematic movies that you just watch widescreen in a Vision Pro, and it's basically like having a theater experience. The other concept is like a full VR, move your head around. You know, we kind of played with that already, didn't we, with 360 video and filmmakers trying to, you know, do that where you have a VR headset and you can look wherever you want while they take you through a scene. That didn't really pick off. Like, that didn't really take off. Do you think like that's still pursuing?
No. I don't think that is. What I see is, I think people would salivate at this concept. Not by people, I mean like companies. Selling one seat a million times at an NBA game.
Right.
Where you put that on and you're there.
Right.
So you would need to recreate the exact feeling of sitting in that chair at a game. So I would need full range of motion all the way around. It needs to be as high res as my eyes. And I would honestly probably pay for that for an NFL game.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a great use case for it, as opposed to like making movies. Still don't think we've developed the like cinematic grammar for doing that.
And then you can do it by without having to talk to any human beings, and you can just sit on your favorite couch, and you don't have to shower, and you can stuff your face with hot dogs and cans of red wine.
I like that you stuffed that one in there, the showering one, like that, and in between the cans of red wine and the you don't have to bathe.
That's great. I think that's a dream, right? Like, why go to a game and like actually like hang out with other people? Gross. COVID. Yuck. I gotcha.
Are you being sarcastic? I cannot tell.
That's the future of watching this podcast, is being in our rooms with us so you can see like, the stacks of like grip accessories and stuff I've just piled over around.
You can sit in my chair together. And you can be me and say like, wow, I got to clean my basement. Oh my God, it's a mess.
I think he's being sarcastic. I think I'm leaning more 60-40. Chris thinks VR is dumb. Is what I'm getting here.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm being old man shouting at the sky
you
about
really
it a
are.
Little bit. Yeah. But I don't see, I see some commercial appeal for it, but I don't know.
We're going to go do that Apple Vision experience, Chris. That is happening. Putting my foot down.
Well, thank goodness that no camera can really support them for quite a while yet. That's all I'm going to say.
All right. Final thing of the week to talk about. And, they're pretty excited about it. I actually haven't really talked to either of you about this, so I'm excited.
I'm excited about it.
Pentax has said that their brand new film camera, which is going to be a fixed lens dual frame, will launch this summer. It's a 35 millimeter, where each time you click the shutter, it's half of the frame of
half frame. Yeah, I'm a little concerned about that.
Frame, yeah,
that's the route they're going. They've been working on it since December of 2022, and it should be ready this year. They did not specify when this year, and they have not specified the name of it or their price target, but only that it's it'll be out in 2024. Thoughts?
And we don't know what lens it has, right? Like, it's a fixed prime or it's a fixed zoom. Prime. Probably fixed prime. Is it a 35 millimeter?
They said fixed lens. I don't know if they... It could be like a fixed, non-removable zoom.
Especially if it's half frame, I could see them putting a zoom in there. Probably around the
30 millimeter area.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Like a beautiful...
I mean, this is what we've been saying. I mean, thumb-driven, which is really cool. I love that. They're obviously going to appeal to the analog crowd that really want that experience. This is kind of what we've been saying Pentax needs to do anyways, like really kind of focus on their heritage, build cameras that are fun, become that specialty manufacturer, right? You know, that niche brand. So yeah, I'm excited to play with it. I don't know if it'll be any good, but it certainly is exciting. And I want to shoot one for sure. I got two rolls of film right here.
I'm fairly certain that when this is available, you guys will be doing a video on it. I think that'll be worth it. I'm curious, do you think it's before I ask, Jordan, what do you think?
I mean, I wish they'd gone, like, it's Pentax. They're always like, what's a weird decision that we can throw in at the last minute on this? I do think half frame is kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
Like, what's selling like crazy are, these like fixed lens point and shoots. Just make a 35 millimeter, one of those with a thumb winder. Everyone would eat it up. I just think they're already starting to make like these things. I don't know if the thought behind it is like people are going to want to see that grain. So let's give them significantly grainier images using that half frame.
It could be cutting your cost in half.
It's confusing.
There's been a couple fixed lens, reloadable, disposable style. I'm putting up the air quotes. Cameras produced by, one's Kodak. And the other one is, I mean, Lomo made a lot of those too. But they've been of the cameras that are coming out that are new film are half frame and they're selling well. That's probably what Pentax is looking at. I kind of wanted to know is it possible? I'm sure it's possible. They can make you'd have to put a battery in it, but a film SLR that takes Pentax's current digital lenses. Could that have been something they could have done and should they?
That would have been great.
Oh, 100% they could have. Yeah, easy. Yeah. I mean, that's what we're saying is they should really remake a lot of their SLRs, full-frame SLRs, although I still think they should make a digital version as well. I think that
would
be better.
So you want them to make two cameras every time they launch? One's going to be the digital.
No. I think this is a brave move because the fact is the market already has a lot of analog film cameras available, right, to buy. I mean, everybody now went crazy buying cameras that would have sold for $15 in a bargain bin. Now they're back up to $150, right? Like all these point-and-shoot cameras. So it's brave that they're doing this. The thumb winder does make me feel like this might be more of a prestigious camera, a little bit more well-built, metal body, like, you know, like a sexy thing to covet as well. Yeah. So I think that's a great move, but yeah, exciting.
Yeah. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
Yep. Hopefully won't have to wait that long.
Reserving judgment, but it's exciting.
That's it for the news. I am now handing over the proctor duties to Jordan, who is going to explain how this is going to go. And all you listeners are as in the dark as me because he told me nothing.
Jaren, you keep things civil here. So first, a little context on why I wanted to do this. So Chris and I, when we were at the camera store, we became friends talking about movies. That's how we hit it off initially. Chris and I had very similar taste in like some of our favorite movies, directors, both recommending like older films or foreign films the other person hadn't seen. That's really like one of the big basis of our friendship. And this is something we do every year. Like Chris and I, we've been going to Oscar parties together for like a decade,
I'd
say at this point, easily. So this is the time of year where we argue about it. The second thing that made me say like, we got to do this on the podcast is when we were on a recent press trip, people just started discussing movies and Chris and I got into it. And Gadgen, another Canadian YouTuber, is like, this is what your podcast should be. Like, you guys should do this. So I think every year we should just throw down about movies a little bit. As well, like Jaren mentioned earlier, I think that films can be incredibly inspiring for like improving your photography. You know, it is photography with moving pictures or your video production work as well. So we're going to do two things. We are going to go through our top five movies, starting at 5, working our way up, alternating.
Is this top 5 of the year or top 5 period?
Top 5 of the year.
Okay. Of 2023.
So a lot of these are going to be 2023 through early 2024.
Exactly.
Anything like, that's up for Oscar.
Of the time frame where it's up for Oscar. Yeah, I think that makes sense. A lot of people are going to be watching those quickly before the ceremony to get context.
Okay.
This is the time to do it.
As I understand
it. So we're going to go through
those. Jordan, as I understand it, like, so yeah, this is not, I mean, this is coming out for the Oscars, but this is not an Oscar prediction podcast at all. This is the movies that we personally enjoy.
That's very
enjoy.
Boring this year because Oppenheimer's going to get everything. So I don't want to do that. So yes, we're going to go through that, and then we're going to talk about the films in that same period with our favorite cinematography as well. We're going to try and keep things fairly snappy, but I'm very curious what everybody's going to think about this, and I want to hear their feedback.
Is this in a particular order? Do we have to go from like our least to our highest?
Yeah, I'm going fifth to first.
Oh, so. I hate that.
Okay, what would you like? You guys get 30 seconds, 40 seconds to make your case for that placement, and then debate.
How about this? As soon as Jaren gets bored and checks out mentally, you can cut us off.
Well, it's going to be a short podcast. No, I mean, we're not
say as well.
We're not like debating Jaren, anything, but we might disagree. No. I mean, okay, let's just see how it disagree. Goes.
This it is has wild. Happened in the past.
This is wild.
And Jaren, you haven't seen many of these movies this year, right?
I'm not a big movie guy anymore. I used to be. And I choose to spend my time differently. I still enjoy movies and I plan to watch some movies over time, but I'm not scrambling to get these things into my eye holes as quickly as possible. So I'm all caught up for the Oscars. I'll watch them eventually, maybe on an airplane. That's how, how Christopher Nolan always envisioned me watching Tenet. Often. And I did that on my iPhone. And you know what? I think that was the best experience possible for that film. So I'll keep doing it.
And it was still a boring film. Okay.
Oh, it was horrible.
I hope you didn't have earbuds in. I hope you were using the built-in phone speaker as well while you were watching the movie.
They frown upon that on aircraft.
All right. I'm going to kick things off then because while Chris is shuffling around his order.
No. And I'm just trying to keep my phone awake.
And I want to start number 5. I was really waffling about this, but this morning I said, like, Ev, I'm doing it. I'm flipping some stuff around on the list. Number 5 is Blackberry, a Canadian movie, which is not up for any Oscars, which is shocking to me about the origin of RIM, R-I-M, and the Blackberry that took the world by storm before the iPhone just completely destroyed it. And this is... people have been trying to make someone invents a product movies for years, ever since The Social Network, and they're all terrible, in my opinion. This is the first one since The Social Network. I think it's the best one. It is super fun, incredibly scrappy. And the thing I love about it is if you're slightly nostalgic for early aughts tech, just the people working in a crummy room with a bunch of PCs whirring and everything like that. They got the look and the vibes so dead on accurate. Mm. It felt exactly like back when I was in college. And the performances are just fantastic on it. There's a lot of very un-Canadian cursing when things start going wrong that is just hysterical.
Un-Canadian?
Very un-Canadian. This is an incredibly Canadian movie.
This has some names in it.
It stars Jay Baruchel, who should be our prime minister at this point, I believe.
He is Canadian.
He's keeping the Canadian film industry alive single-handedly. Just a great power trip showing what money can eventually cause you to morally spiral.
Wow, okay. I think that was well over 30
great
seconds.
Movie. Yeah, you're absolutely cutting you off.
Check it out. Can't recommend it enough.
I haven't seen it, but it sounds boring. A rip-roaring thrill ride.
So good.
You know, first off, can I just guess your top 5, Jordan? Because I think beyond this, your top 5 is going to be Die Hard, Expendables 4, probably The Marvels, and then Aquaman as your top. Is that correct?
I was so ready for him to be serious, and then he just...
There's some surprises.
Let me
for sure, Chris,
down.
If you're thinking that.
All right, sorry.
Chris, you're number 5.
Okay, my number 5. So I want to paraphrase this. This does not count on my 30 seconds. So Jordan and I started our friendship by really agreeing on a lot of foreign films. Now we continue our friendship by disagreeing on a lot of movies. And I think that's beautiful. It's that Jordan and I see movies in a very different way. We key on to very different things that appeal to us. And for me, I like movies that kind of either make me feel something or... entertain me. I'm fine with suspending disbelief. I would say Jordan is maybe a little bit higher on the snob scale in that regard, but I respect his choices. But my movies, I like to pick based on how they make me feel. So
All right, 2020. Now I'm starting your time. It's time.
Okay.
Number five.
So 2023, I feel like we had a lot of nostalgia. We had a lot of, which I know Jordan hates, we have a lot of nostalgia, a lot of sequels. We got like Super Mario Brothers, Guardians of the Galaxy was new, Evil Dead came back, The Exorcist came back, largely terrible. Mission Impossible, you know, Gran Turismo, all these things that's like, it's these attempts at nostalgia. And my top, my first of my top five, it just edged out Society of the Snow, which is a great movie, but I had to push it out. I was sad about that. I'm going with Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, because this movie really did click the nostalgia bell for me in such a cute way. And yet my boys watched it. They don't play Dungeons and Dragons. That's like, you know, after their time in a lot of ways, the golden era. And they also really enjoyed it. I think it was such a well done movie. Chris Pine's eminently charming. It's a great homage, lots of Easter eggs, but it's also like legit funny, entertaining, well-paced and very well cast. So Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, that's my five of the top five of 2023.
I've heard nothing but great things about that movie.
Yeah, you should watch it.
I'm actually going to watch it, even though it's not in the wheelhouse of something I would ever watch.
Chris, you spent 27 seconds before you actually said your movie. You should try and get to the movie sooner.
Doesn't matter. No, totally worth it.
For the next role.
I guarantee Jordan will take more time than I will, so I don't feel bad at all.
All right, Jordan, your number. You actually have no complaints about that one. I haven't seen it.
I've heard it's really good.
Yeah, me too. All right, Jordan, your number four starts now.
My number four is Killers of the Flower Moon, the latest by Martin Scorsese, which is, yes, it's a long movie. That seems to be all people talk
about,
really annoying, because it is absolutely one of his most, it is a very entertaining movie, even though it's extremely dark. Like, I was looking forward to getting back into it. I did have to break it up over a couple of viewings. But the performances, no one's talking about Robert De Niro in this thing. Like, this is the best acting he's done in 20 years. Lily Gladstone's obviously amazing. And DiCaprio plays the most like conflicting,
sad,
unlikable
sack
person I've seen in a very long time. It's a fantastic performance. I think it's one of Scorsese, certainly in like his top 10 movies, which is kind of incredible because he's made a lot of brilliant movies. So love Killers of the Flower Moon.
You know, I'm not going to disagree with you on this. It is in his top 10 of greatest movies because he's made a lot of subpar mediocre movies. Jordan, and so this does stand out because Jordan and I disagree on this. Like, Scorsese, I respect him as director. Obviously, he's made some amazing stuff. Everything he makes is very well crafted. I just don't think all his movies are that interesting or entertaining. And I think he gets a lot of maybe more fanfare than he should because his early, he's made some masterpieces, bar none. But anyways, I did enjoy this movie. I will say that given its incredibly long runtime, it is actually fairly entertaining. It does keep you engaged. It does let you stop and look at a lot of the sort of digest a lot of the relationship that's going on. It is a movie about a marriage, though, and that part's really compelling. I still think it's way too long. I think it did drag on. I will say, though, the story was very interesting, and it's not a story that I ever heard of, and a movie that makes me go afterwards and then research heavily, I always consider like a good project. Yeah. So I wouldn't put it that high up, but I agree it was a good film.
One thing I want to say quickly, I like expensive movies where they build sets and light things and have extras. It feels like a big budget movie from the early 2000s and it rocks.
Yeah, it was long like The Irishman, but it was, you know, like five times as entertaining. Well, because Irishman's, blech.
Chris, I'm going to stop timing you because you guys are just interesting to listen to. So I don't feel like the timer is necessary. Chris, what is your number four?
Oh, so number four, I'm going to put Oppenheimer in there. And I know this is going to get a lot of it's. I almost feel dirty picking the movie that's
the Nolan
like
bros are coming for you.
Like, but you can't deny like Killian's been in so many of Nolan's movies, but always a supporting role. This is like his first like really big lead, and he kills it. And what I found most fascinating about Oppenheimer is it's not the project, the Manhattan Project. It's almost just like a plot line to really talk about the man, and that was what was really interesting. I mean, I already know the project; I know it very well. And so, what I didn't know was about Oppenheimer himself. And I think that's such a beautiful approach. Beautifully shot, of course. Very interesting. I love the guy was like a total playboy. I mean, I had no idea, right? Like this scientist was just he's got the riz. Is that what kids say? I don't know. Yep.
He's got riz.
But you know,
Oppie's got the riz.
Yeah,
that's a t-shirt.
And then, although it is also long, I think the way it flips into a courtroom procedural, it was very well done. It was compelling. You know, it was enthralling. It's a great film. No denying it, but I still don't think it's my favorite. I think there's more interesting films, but it was so well crafted and it deserves to be on the awards podium for sure.
Yeah, I love Oppenheimer as well. And the one thing I really love about it is I find Nolan to be a very literal filmmaker. He's like, I have to explain everything in this movie. There can be no room for interpretation. Where he really dips into like kind of arty like cutaways to things that don't exist. Like in the courtroom scene, there's that sex scene in the middle of it. Or, you know, when he's imagining the people getting devastated by the bomb. And I think it just shows real growth as a filmmaker. And we're going to talk about it later for sure. But Oppenheimer, I totally agree, is I think it's Nolan's best movie. But no, Interstellar, second best movie.
Yeah, Interstellar.
Yeah.
All right, Jordan, what's your number four?
Your
number three. You went first.
Poor Things. I thought this was one of the most fun movies I've seen this year. It's basically like a Frankenstein movie where they put the brain of a baby into an adult woman and she goes on adventures in a weird like science fiction mystical land. I think I have had two kids. You can immediately identify Emma Stone's performance as a toddler is the funniest thing I've seen in the movies this year. It is like, and I know she has a young kid. It is perfect.
I didn't think it was that
so much fun to watch. Really interestingly photographed as well. But my favorite joke in the movies this year is when a baby starts crying and she doesn't understand anything about parenthood. So she's like, oh, I need to go punch this baby. And I think it's just one of my favorite like off the sideline deliveries. Really enjoyable movie. Great supporting cast as well. Yeah. So good movie. Poor Things. Number three.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, this kind of wrecks it, but I'm not going to rebuke you now or anything like that because it's on my list as well. So maybe when I get to that, I'll talk about my opinion on it, but
perfect.
I was
hoping there'd be some overlap.
Oh, there's some overlap. Yeah. So my number three, I'm going to give to The Holdovers. You know, Alexander Payne makes fantastic movies. It's funny. Every time I see the trailers for his movies, I'm like, this movie looks like dog poop. Like, this sounds boring. Blah. It took me forever to watch Nebraska. And then I watched Nebraska and I was like, oh my God, this is transcendent. Like, it was for me, like a perfect film, like near perfect film. And so The Holdovers, it was kind of the same thing. I'm like, oh, like a boarding school in the 70s, like, you know, over for Christmas. This doesn't sound that interesting. But I'm like, no, I'm going to watch it. And it was fantastic. I mean, first off, filmed in such a convincing way to really bring you back to the 70s and make you feel that the color palette, choices optically, like the crash zooms and stuff, like used in a way that just is very old school. Giamatti, I think this is one of his best performances. I watched Sideways right after because my wife had never seen Sideways. I'm like, oh, we got to watch this.
Sideways
and
slaps.
I love Giamatti and Sideways, but when you see the difference, right one after the other, Holdovers is so much more nuanced performance, so much more touching, so much more powerful, even though they're actually playing like very similar characters in a lot of way, like just these down on their luck intellectuals that have a hard time connecting with people. But I mean, all the performances are amazing in this. It's beautifully shot. It's touching, like the ending. Oh, like it just grabbed me emotionally. And so I think it's, again, like he always consistently makes these beautiful films that just are really human, really simple, really accessible, and yet just draw you in. Like, I can't help but being drawn in.
I really loved that movie as well, and I'm a huge Alexander Payne junkie. It would be lower in my ranking of his movies, but that's only because, like, I think, you know, Sideways, Election, Nebraska are
some of the best
movies ever made. But yeah, it's just such, and it's nice to actually have a good Christmas feel-good movie. That's a genre I am not into at all, but I'll probably be rolling out The Holdovers every Christmas for a long time.
Maybe so. I'll watch. I
totally
like
agree.
Christmas
almost
movies.
Made it.
Maybe I will watch that this Christmas.
And you know what? The Christmas aspect is a part of it, but it's not a huge part of it. Like it's really just like, it's a very touching human drama, and you don't
drama.
Think it will be drama. Yep.
All right. Jordan, what's your number two?
Number two, this is going to be a controversial one, but I loved Maestro, Bradley Cooper's second movie after A Star is Born. It's the story of Leonard Bernstein, but it's not the story of Leonard Bernstein. And that's why everyone got mad about it. You know, this is one of the most important composers of this century, if not the most important. And it does not talk about the music very much. It's certainly like a sidebar. This is about his marriage. You know, he was a gay man who was married for a long while and had an ongoing relationship with his wife that is really compelling. And that's what Bradley Cooper explores with this. So if you want to hear about like writing West Side Story with Stephen Sondheim, it's not going to do that. And I think that really frustrated a lot of people. But the photography in this is unbelievable, using a bunch of different types of film stocks. Bradley Cooper's performance is fantastic. And this is the best old age makeup I have ever seen in a movie. It's incredibly convincing. And there's a lot of really cool cinematic tricks. Like this is a very directed movie where he'll like jump out of his bed and all of a sudden he's in the orchestra pit and stuff like that. I think this movie really didn't get a fair shake. And you should definitely check it out if you haven't already. Yeah, just know what you're getting. This is a study of a marriage.
The reviews of it are very middling. And you're saying it's just because the expectation was not met by what the movie actually was.
I think that's
a
huge part of it. And I do think people are annoyed with Bradley Cooper, just desperately trying to become one of the most important filmmakers as quickly as possible. Right. And I think A Star is Born as well is an absolute masterpiece.
It
I think
is,
he's incredibly talented. He just needs to chill out a little bit.
So, I tried my hardest to watch as many films as possible. I think we both did, right? We're trying to cram these movies in. You know, we do have Oscar parties coming up as well that we like to do, so we always want to be as educated as possible. Maestro is one that I didn't get around to. Honestly, I didn't find the premise that interesting, but it's, and that's nothing bad about the film. That was just me personally. I was like, oh, I'll put it further down the list. But Jordan and I, we often talk about movies in the car, and we do disagree on a lot of films, and not just why we like, or not just the film itself, but why we like them and what it is that triggers us about them and that we attach to. And so we're talking to the car and I'm like, Jordan's like, I love Maestro, so good. I don't know if you'd really enjoy it. And I do respect his opinion on that because we disagree so often that we really reach a point where we're like, yeah, it's not for you. Like, given what you've reacted to in the past, you probably won't like it. So because of that, I blame Jordan for not watching it. So I can't speak to it, but it does sound interesting. I think I will absolutely follow his recommendation and give it a watch, but unfortunately not in time for this podcast.
What's your number two?
My number two, I did just see this last night and it really blew me away. It was Anatomy of a Fall. I loved it.
Oh, I loved Anatomy. Yes, oh, man. That's my wife's pick for movie of the year.
Yeah, it's really high up there. So such a simple premise. The acting is really what drives you home. I mean, these characters that you don't get a lot of backstory and it's all revealed to you right when you need it. Like the director did such a great job of you're like, okay, well, why are we in this situation? And then boom, you find out it's just given to you, not force fed down your throat, just really intelligently. You're like, you know, why would this person react that way? And then, oh, they explain it in a very intelligent way. The acting is beautiful. It's real. It's like, I really felt like these were actual people that I was watching. And that's so important for me to then really be able to connect to them emotionally. All the actors. I mean, the boy
the
who plays this
really cool. I love this poster, the movie poster.
It's so good. And it's such an interesting premise. And then at the end of it, it really makes you keep thinking because, you know, I don't want to wreck it, but basically it's a court procedural. It's like, you know, is this person innocent or guilty? And in the end, the director really says, it's up to you to decide that. It's left in an ambiguous way where it's like, you have to really look at your own biases, your own sort of past history, how you react as a parent. I think it would be different as a husband or wife in this situation, how you react to it. And so I thought it was like really brilliantly done, so compelling, funny in certain ways at times, like, but in such a human way. One of the most human films. And I also want to say the way that they use language, like French and English, in a way that really sets the main actor apart from what she's experiencing and really pushes her away from everybody. But at the same time, for English speaking viewers, kind of like lets you engage and sympathize. I thought it was super smart, super smart.
You can tell when Chris has strong opinions about something that he feels really, really about because you can hear it in his voice.
Yeah, no, I really love that movie. My big takeaway from it is I want nothing but French courtroom dramas, because French court seems to be bananas. They're just like, I don't know. Well, I'm going to allow anything that you guys want to do here.
There's no objections.
You know, they're almost like, is she guilty? We're going to choose by show of applause. Like, it's nuts. So super fun on that. So I don't know how authentic that is, but no, that is a great movie and some really interesting choices in terms of audio as well in that. They do some cool stuff with silence because one of the kids is deaf.
No, he's not deaf. He's almost blind.
Almost blind. I'm sorry. So they heighten the sound and it's very, very cool.
All right. Here we go. It's all come down to this. Jordan, what's your favorite movie of the year?
My favorite movie of the year has been sitting right at the top for a very long time. This came out early in the year. It is Past Lives.
Oh, barf.
I love this movie. Chris does not. I knew this was going to be kind of the contentious point of it. But so the basic premise here is there's a woman who goes on a single date with a boy in Korea when she's 12 years old, when they're both 12 years old. They don't see each other and then reconnect online 10 years later in their early 20s. Then they sever that. And then another 10 years later, in their early 30s, he comes to New York City, where she lives with, surprise, her husband. And it plays out a very interesting, not contrived dynamic that I've never seen in movies before, where they're all very good people. There's no bad guys here. It'd be so easy to be like, her husband's a jerk, and now this long-lost lover comes back into her life. It is not that at all. It's also one of the best directed movies I've seen this century in terms of a lot of the decisions that she makes, especially the final scene in this movie, where it takes place in one long take. I'm not going to spoil too much of it, but the way that the camera moves is so deliberate, so theatrical, and just enhances the mood so much. This is a movie I'm going to go back to all the time. I think it's so well acted, so well written as well. Feels very naturalistic, but they hit every dialogue point you need these characters to. I think it's a masterpiece, and I think it's a shame. Like, it's well reviewed, but nobody's putting it at the top for the Oscars this year.
Yeah, because it's not that good.
I love it. Okay, go ahead. Tell me why I'm wrong, Chris.
Okay, it's not barf. That was maybe just me reacting because I want to give Jordan a hard time.
Yeah, if Celine Song is a listener, I'm sorry for what Chris has done.
This is like, I think we said this already. This is like my Drive My Car for this year. Like,
love Drive My Car.
I think Drive My Car was actually a more compelling film, and I still didn't like it that much. Like, It's well crafted. I think Tao Yu specifically does a great job in this. Greta Lee carries the film absolutely. The performances are great. It's just not a very interesting story. And I think for me, if you're gonna focus on this love story and the longing, it just didn't resonate there. It just didn't quite grab me. And I mean, I fall in love plenty of times when I was 12. I get it, but I just don't understand this relationship, why they're so drawn to each other. I don't feel like enough was made to really make them that powerful a connection, that it would really haunt both of them. You know, because that's the thing. I mean, they're both haunted by this relationship, but I don't see it. And so I guess if you don't get that hook in to the viewer, they're just not going to respond the way you want them to throughout the ride. So again, beautifully acted. Very well crafted. I just don't think the emotional impact was there to hook me properly. I mean, my wife saw it. She was like, yeah, it was fine. I enjoyed it. Like, you know, that's okay, the kind of film too. It is. It's like, yeah, it was fine. It was good, you know, but number one in your pick, you're crazy.
I mean, this is the beauty of films is art is a subjective experience.
Yes, 100%.
And we should remember that sometimes.
100%. Nothing wrong with the film. It's just, there's nothing great with the film either.
I'm trying to see... Which one you're... I can't... Is it going to be one we've already talked about?
I think I know what
it is. My number one? Yeah. So my number one is Poor Things.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And this is a film that I wouldn't normally pick... Well, no, that's not true, because I picked it. But it's a film that I wouldn't always respond. Like, you know, I do like artsy films. I like films that kind of go beyond. But they're typically not something I'm going to say is the best film of the year. But Poor Things... Watching the first, my wife and I are sitting in the theater, we're watching the first 20 minutes, which is mostly in black and white, very odd, very strange, lots of fisheye use. I mean, that's a hallmark. And you watching the movie and I'm turning to her and I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, I hope this is, I don't know, like this might really be just too far out there. And then it just grows, like the character grows from being a toddler to an adult. It just starts to grow. And you start to realize that beginning is really to show how chaotic and strange and weird the world is, but also just being that age and having to grow and having to learn. And then as it becomes more and more grounded, you just really get more and more pulled in, switches to color, funny as hell. I mean, this, like, Mark Ruffalo, I know you talk about the supporting cast.
Incredible.
Mark Ruffalo, like, steals every scene, but legit hilarious. Emma Stone's performance, I mean, she has a lot on her shoulders for this film and just does an amazing job with it. Willem Dafoe, I mean, all the characters are great. The artwork is interesting. The set design is, like, luscious and beautiful. But yeah, it's a kind
the
of film
full
where
CGI
I
get scenes look like garbage.
You're
that
crazy.
Would be my big strike against
no,
it.
No, you're wrong. Just made me do an emotional 180 where I'm like, what is this bizarre world? It's so uncomfortable and then really draws you in and then gets you laughing. The ending kind of falls a little bit flat, but it just had such an emotional impact on me. The experience where you leave the theater, that's what, for me, that's what I want, is where you leave the theater and you kind of sit there for a little bit in your chair after the credits roll and you're just like, wow, like, what did we just watch? And then you can't help but just talk about it over and over with your friend or your partner, or your spouse, whatever. And you're just like back and forth, like, oh yeah. And then this and this and this. And to me, that's really the hallmark of a great film. And then you think about it for days afterwards and you think about scenes and you think about the jokes and stuff. And so it just really grabbed me. It stayed in my mind for a long time. For me, that's the hallmark of what I would consider like one of my favorite films.
Yeah. And one we definitely agreed on. I like the ending, actually. But, that's one thing I'll push back on you. I think it makes sense as a fairy tale ending. But anyways, man, we have gone long and we still want to do cinematography. So I say we speed round this thing.
Okay. So you want to do five best cinematographies? Or five?
Let's just do it fast.
Okay.
And I don't think we should. Do you want to go back and forth again, Chris? Or should we just rattle them
off? Yeah, let's go back and forth, but we'll do it quick.
Okay, perfect. So using the exact same order, my number five is The Holdovers. I love that this is not shot on film, but they shoot it in a very classic way that really reminds you of 70s film, like Chris mentioned there. If you're looking to get some inspiration on kind of like classic technique, especially things like those snap zooms, this is a fun lesson in making something feel nostalgic.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm going to go with Poor Things would be number five, Robbie Ryan. Again, I think he built a really interesting fantasy world, lots of real world stuff, lots of set pieces, some CGI, which I didn't think was terrible. The animal stitched together looked very convincing. It was very good. So Poor Things, Robbie Ryan, I think it was a beautiful world that he built, fantasy world.
My number four, Killers of the Flower Moon, is just a big, glossy, beautiful movie. There is a scene where there's a fire outside and they shoot it through kind of like textured glass inside the house. That's one of the more incredible visuals I've seen in the movies this year. Some very cool aerial stuff as well in this. And again, it's just the kind of Hollywood filmmaking I really miss. I'm going to go buy a big plane of pane of glass with some texture on it and shoot some fire behind it, because damn, that looked cool.
So this was going to be my number three, but I'll make it my number four just so that we can get through this quicker. Killers of the Flower Moon, I'll agree with you, Jordan. Like, I thought, I mean, Rodrigo Prieto, he's done so many great films, right? I mean, beautiful films, not necessarily great
Barbie
films.
Barbie and this in the same year. That's
but I mean, like,
nuts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a glossy Western, beautifully shot, really uses the landscape. I mean, he did Brokeback Mountain. He did Beautiful. He did Silence. Like, Amoros Perros. Barbie as well, I think we should mention. He also did Barbie, right? So he's really good at building these fantasy worlds, but also showing the range of just a beautiful grounded Western using the landscape. I'll make that number four.
Next up, Eric Messerschmidt's work on The Killer is just a great example of, like, very kind of the opposite of The Holdovers. Every modern trick is put to work here on this movie. And I think the way that they handle, especially like working with a telephoto, a lot of the really long lenses, but still with very well-composed shots, is a really exciting kind of look to it. I mean, The Killer is a very pulpy movie, but it just shows like what happens when you put some of the most talented people in the world to work on something like that. You can make something insanely compelling. I really love The Killer. I think it should have been in the running. And I think the cinematography is one of the most exciting things about it. Nah. So The Killer, my number three for cinematography.
All right. So this was going to be my number four, but now it'll be my number three just because of The Killers, how we changed that. But I'm going to go with Robert Yeoman in Asteroid City. And I love Wes Anderson movies.
Love Yeoman.
I didn't like Asteroid City that much, but the cinematography is cool. I mean, people talked about that color palette for months afterwards, right? And it is a very interesting color palette, but also some beautifully composed scenes. I love the conversation, that Schwartzman and Johansson are having between the windows of their separate hotel rooms. I just thought, it was well shot, interesting angles, quirky and fun. The alien scenes, all of it was very beautifully shot. And
the black and white
felt
stunning.
Yeah, the black and white was beautiful. It still felt very much like a Wes Anderson film. So yeah, maybe the script was weak, the story wasn't as good, but I thought visually it was gorgeous.
Yeah, I liked that movie a little more than you, but I think the cinematography is a big part of the appeal. I'm going to go my number two, Maestro. They mix so many types of photograph, like shot on 16mm, shot on old video to really show the differences through the ages. But as I mentioned, just some of the most creative transitions that I've seen in the movies. Everybody's smoking, which is the secret to make a good looking movie, is just make sure everybody in the frame is smoking at all times so you can get those nice shafts of light. And yes, the black and white photography on this is some of the best black and white photography I've seen again this century. So definitely, even if you're not super into the story, like you mentioned, Chris, you're not sure if this is a movie you're going to jump on, and I've almost told you are, it's worth just looking at the images. I mean, I think Maddie Libatique is one of our best cinematographers working right now.
So I am going to go with the big one here again. I can't not. I mean, Hoyt van Hoytema, fantastic. I mean, amazing cinematographer. So Oppenheimer is beautiful. You can't deny it. I mean, first off, the color palette is very interesting. If we're talking about stuff that appeals to photographers and the sort of look of things, the color palette, I think, is beautiful, muted, almost cross-processed in some cases. Obviously, all the practical effects for the explosions and the reactions and stuff was very interesting. But I also thought it was just a very thoughtfully shot, grounded film. It always let the actors really show their relationships with each other in very simple ways. So yeah, Hoyt van Hoytema, you can't, I mean, yeah. What are you going to say, right?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to say, because that's my number one for best cinematography of the year, is Hoyt for Oppenheimer. Yeah. I've really kind of butted up against some of the large format photography that he's been doing over the last, a lot of the IMAX stuff, just struggling with focus in some scenes in Interstellar, or it drawing too much attention to itself, where I really feel like he absolutely hit the perfect balance with this as well. I can't say it enough. Super shallow depth of field, wide angle. Close-ups are amazing. I mean, this is
how Lubezki got it.
Yeah, exactly. That's how his big trick. And I think it's done even better in this. It just immediately makes you think, what is this person thinking? Tries to get you into their head. And the best close-ups by far, I would say, are in Oppenheimer this year. And big wide vistas, just serving the story at every single shot. We should say, it's crazy that an R-rated movie that ends in a courtroom drama about, developing the atomic bomb turned into one of the biggest blockbusters of the year. Yeah. I think it's because of his visual storytelling. It felt like an event.
Oh, look, we agreed. We agreed. So my number one, I don't know if you saw this, Jordan. I don't think you did. I'm going with Pavel Pogorzelski for Beau is Afraid. And this was a movie, it is such a crazy fever dream to be able to keep it conceptually together visually, just with the camera work, especially in the early scenes where Beau's in his apartment. I just thought it was beautifully done. There's thoughtful camera movements, drawing the character through, but at the same time, letting you see the story, but the camera work still makes you very nervous. It makes you very uncomfortable, and that's exactly how you want to feel. And then as the movie progresses, it totally changes into slower work, more grounded work, theatrical set pieces. And the theater part in the middle is like beautifully done, to the judgment at the ending. I mean, I don't know. You got to watch it. It's too complicated to explain, but I think Pavel did a very challenging movie, and the camera work is such a big part of how that plays out, how you react to it, how it makes you feel emotionally. And I think cinematography has to go beyond just like, oh, it's beautiful and it's compelling.
Yeah,
it really has to be able to make you feel what the character's feeling or immerse you in their experience. And Pavel does an amazing job in both.
I saw parts of that over your shoulder on an airplane, and it made me want to watch it immediately. I'm like, that shot is insane.
Yeah, the shots are insane. You definitely especially have to watch it.
Like, we're talking about camera movement a lot, but the lighting on that too is just so inventive. Yes. And still motivated. So yeah, I'm gonna check that out for sure.
That's 100%. That's you'll love happen. It.
I'm so scared it, Chris. At some point that I'm gonna be on an airplane with both of you sitting next to you, and it will be a nightmare for me because you'll see me scrolling through the movies that are available, and both of you will be shaking me. That one, and neither of you are gonna agree, and it's going to be horrible.
Yeah. Jared has this thing where Jordan and I disagree. We're all driving together, like Idaho is a big one, and we're talking about like our favorite shows and movies, and I keep shouting at him, "You need to watch this. If you don't, you're a soulless monster, and I don't want to be a friend anymore." And you still don't. But it comes from the sweetest, most generous part of my soul, and I hate both of you. So yeah, it's I feel bad for Jaren because I'm like, you got to watch the Terror season one. Why haven't you? You're a monster.
I do want to watch the Terror season.
Yeah, you need to. But does anybody else get this feeling when you're on an airplane? I want to watch interesting films, but then I'm always so self-conscious that like the person right behind me is watching like two people bang on screen or some horrible, vicious murder. And I'm just like, maybe I should just watch a Disney film or something. Like, I don't know.
Just put on a Marvel movie for the fifth time in a row. I've done that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
like I'm sitting in we're sitting in the plane on their last trip, sorry, and then a good friend of mine, he's watching a German, looks like a TV documentary, and it's like teenage girl risque kind of coming of age. I'll let your imagination go where it goes, but I'm like, dude, like whoa, and I'm not paying attention to my movie. I'm like, this is very distracting, and I feel like airplanes super distracting.
My airplane recommendation for you, we should have one for Jaren, do Blackberry. That's my airplane recommendation.
Yeah, there you go. Safe.
I tend to like movies like that. But I also want to watch the Dungeons and Dragons movie. Do also want to watch Oppenheimer. I have not seen that yet. And Anatomy of a Fall looks really good.
Oh, it's so good.
And I think I'll watch both Poor Things and The Holdovers. We typically do What Have You Been Up To here, but you guys have been watching movies. So in this week, what I want to do is actually, since I actually don't watch a lot of movies, I watch a lot of shows. I watch TV. I tend to like the pacing of TV more than I like the pacing of movies. And so the shows that I'm watching right now that I would recommend, which will never win Oscars because they're shows.
But we're going to agree on this.
One of them for sure is Shogun.
Yes.
It is possibly the most interestingly shot and so far paced movies or show. See, it feels like a movie shows I've ever seen. It is incredibly good. There is the very aggressive use, at least in episode two, of a 28mm that gets me every time. Love it. Love that. Love the absolute wide angle with a centered subject. You see the horizons bending behind it. The bokeh of that particular lens is also really kind of dreamy and swirly
corners. Looks like shift. Really cool.
Love it.
Yeah.
I'm very much enjoying it. Episode three is on tonight. I will watch it. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, I'm going to watch it too.
I'm sorry. I just want to get on my soapbox about Shogun just very quickly. If you're considering boiling a person, don't do it. It's just it's kind of gross. Whoa, just don't be boiling people.
That's my culture.
I know this is culturally insensitive of me to see. It just seems like a mean way to do it.
How dare you?
I would like to see less boiling alive of people.
It doesn't last that long.
You know, towards the end, it's kind of gross too. Yeah. So just don't do it, everybody. If you're thinking about doing it, don't boil people.
Yeah.
Sorry, back to you, Jaren.
On that note, that actor, Takahiro Hira, fantastic. Love his character of Ishido. He's really good. But I'm just so happy. I'm over here like clapping every episode, seeing Hiroyuki Sanada get a lead role and just kill it. I've always loved him playing this similar style role. I think his role in The Last Samurai is one of the best characters in that movie, in a movie about a white savior. But he is in there being the baddest guy on the field. Like, just
amazing, I love my white saviors. Amazing. I love my white saviors.
And the other thing that I would recommend anyone who likes to watch this sort of thing is I would recommend The Apothecary Diaries. This is an anime.
Interesting.
And it is exceptional. It is a movie about a girl who was raised by an apothecary to understand how drugs and different types of herbs and stuff work. And she gets abducted basically into slavery, but she gets sold to the emperor's. This takes place in China. So she gets sold to the emperor's service and works in like the, you know, the where all the wives live. And she eventually works her way up because she solves basically medical mysteries set in ancient China. And it's very, very interesting. The way that the second half of season one is going, I'm very much enjoying. It's still actively airing. You can watch it on Crunchyroll. And it is, I love it. I think the music, the pacing, the way that you can't say the shots because it's drawn or computer animated, but the way that they've constructed scenes is, I think, very good. It doesn't go over the top with anime and Japanese style humor, although it's still in there to a degree that I like. And anyway, I think it's very good. So those are my two things. Very different.
Check that out.
Shogun and the Apothecary Diaries.
And I'm digging Shogun. Yeah.
If you like the actor who plays Ishido, you should watch, I've told Jordan this so many times, Giri Haji is incredible. It's a London Japanese co-production, like a BBC Japan co-production. It is short. It's just like one season. It's so well acted. Yeah, Will Sharp is amazing as Rodney. All the characters are fantastic. I mean, it's Sarah McDonald. Everybody loves Sarah McDonald. And it just jumps back and forth between London and Japan. And the ending is brilliant in a very theatrical way. Sorry?
Kelly McDonald? There is no
Kelly McDonald. One of the McDonalds.
Her name in the show is Sarah.
Ah, there you go. But it's Kelly McDonald. You should absolutely watch that series as well. All right, okay. I'm done.
That's it. We don't have time to go into more, but we appreciate y'all listening. Hopefully, we'd like to hear your feedback. Let them know what you think of their selections for best picture and best cinematographer. We'll read them in the comments. I'm sure they'll engage. Chris is in there, and so is Jordan very often. So let us know your thoughts. And with that, we are going to move on to tech support, where we have a few questions that the boys are going to answer. The first one is from Nathaniel. This is a speak pipe. Let's listen to what he's got to say.
Hi there. Greetings from Sweden. My name is Nathaniel, and I have worked as a wedding photographer for some years now. I also do some video work on the side. I have used Canon my entire career, and I've tried some Sony, Nikon, and Fuji, but I've always come back to Canon for its ease of use and stability. Most of my issues with Sony has now been resolved, and I once again are looking to their lineup. Two issues were the bodies slash handling and the menus. I feel that has been greatly improved. The things that bother me most with Canon right now is its video capabilities and its offering of lenses and non-offering of third-party lenses. Except for the points already made here, which are the biggest differences and cons slash pros of Canon versus Sony? I should also mention that I'm using a Canon R5 and an R6. Bye.
Wow, we certainly talked about this, Nathaniel, where Sony has come a long way in its menu systems and its interface, and I think it's very effective now. Canon, the third-party lenses, maybe they'll soften on that, but as it is now, it's still going to take time. So Sony also does give you incredibly huge lens lineup, right? So many choices of budget, of price range, of quality, of manufacturer, so you get a lot of options there. And I think especially R5, R6 right now, the R6 Mark II, the new cameras, they actually focus really well, but you'll notice a step up in autofocus performance, certainly from an R5. That being said, I still do think that Canon have some of the nicest interfaces. The lenses they make are absolutely fantastic for the most part. They're just kind of expensive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, my big thing, if you're talking about video, I feel like Sony's made a real move to put professional video features in all of their cameras, where Canon seems very determined to segment them. You know, they have the R5C if you want a more cinema styled thing. And I think they're going to continue to do that, is the impression that I'm getting from their bodies. So if you are looking for a single hybrid body to do both gigs, I think, yeah, certainly Sony is offering more compelling options on that front. So that would make perfect sense for me. But if you are worried about, like you said, the menus, those have definitely improved. The other big thing, though, is Sony, all their bodies are very small. So if you're like me and you prefer a little bit larger body. I prefer the handling of the R5, R6. Sony's not going to change that. You know, they've certainly improved the ergonomics, but they're all the same small bodies with very similar handling. And if you don't love that, then it might not be the brand for you.
You know, this might be not what you wanted to hear. And coming from a guy who's using a Canon camera right now, I do think that right now, if this is what you're looking for, Nikon is a better choice overall. I think Nikon has a better availability of lenses. It's kind of in between Canon and Sony. I think the Z8, as these two would say,
yes,
is probably the best hybrid that I've used in quite some time. And when I was shooting with it, with Chris, I found myself being like, man, I don't really want to give this camera back to Chris. I'm having a good time with it. So like, yeah. I very much don't look past Nikon, especially with the history of them not really supporting video very well. They've gotten over that hump, and the Z8 is a very good video camera and a very good photo camera. So it's cool. Just, you know, to challenge you further and make you not make a decision right away. Think about
that. Helps. Good luck, Daniel.
Yeah. And right, there's third party lenses for Nikon now.
Yeah. All right. Next one is another SpeakPike. This one is from Shahaf.
Hi. Thank you for a great podcast. If the camera manufacturers manipulate the lenses so they are giving the best output, how come there is a big difference between lenses? Why the manufacturer don't manipulate all lenses to be perfect?
All right, so Shahaf, to give some context, you know, to the viewers that are listening as well and stuff. So what we're talking about is how whenever you design a lens, you have certain envelopes that you have to push. And if you go in one direction, really doing a good job correcting distortion, you might have to give up somewhere else like sharpness. And so all the engineers are playing this balancing act of where do we excel in one area or, you know, all around. And what we're saying is a lot of modern lenses now, they can avoid correcting things optically like distortion, for example, because it can be, or CA, because it can be corrected digitally afterwards in post. And that frees them up to push those envelopes more towards things like flare protection. Sharpness is a big one, especially with high resolution sensors nowadays. And so that's kind of what we're talking about. Now, technically speaking, you can engineer lenses to have excellent performance all throughout. Why manufacturers don't do it is because that's incredibly expensive to do. Yeah. It requires fancy glass, very complicated formulas. There are some limits, I'm sure, where you just can't do it. It's just too much that you're asking. But, you know, that's where you really get into the more premium manufacturers, your G Master lenses, your Leica lenses, your professional series S lenses from Nikon. You know, more money does mean you can push the envelope further. So why there's a big difference between lenses is because of cost, because of budget, because of market, where you want to place those lenses. And digital correction is very useful, but can only do so much. So that's why.
Yeah, I really remember the old Otis series from Zeiss where they were just like, look, we're not going to make any compromises. These are going to be our sharpest lenses with the best flare control. And they were absolutely huge, and they were $5,000 a pop for photography lenses. And they were manual focus. That's the trade-off. If you want that kind of performance, there's going to be some compromises somewhere.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. Amateur photography Michelle. Michelle, they asked on YouTube, or said on YouTube and then asked, thanks for the great show you put on. Here's a question for tech support. How does EV compensation work behind the scenes? When I look at the aperture or the diaphragm opening of or the ISO, they seem to stay the same. If I increase the EV by, say, 2 stops, so I just boost the signal, and does that generate noise? Finally, could I use reduced EV instead of an ND filter, for example?
So exposure value compensation, it's not doing anything magical. So just to explain it, I mean, it still can only manipulate either aperture, shutter speed, or ISO. And so it really depends on what mode your camera's in. If you're in shutter priority, for example, EV is not going to affect the shutter speed. It'll very likely change the aperture instead. You know, vice versa, if you're in aperture priority, it will change the shutter speed for you, not the aperture. You can also use EV to change the ISO, like in an auto ISO kind of situation. That's generally not done. Usually EV is really manipulating either aperture or shutter speed. One possible reason why you might not see a change to the ISO and aperture and shutter speed is on some cameras in manual mode, you have to turn on a setting where EV will actually change something in manual mode. Usually in manual mode, it's up to you to change ISO or aperture or shutter speed yourself to actually manipulate the exposure. And a lot of times EV compensation won't actually have an effect. So that must be it. you cannot use a reduced EV, for example, to mimic an ND filter because you're not losing light. You would just be shutting your aperture down tighter or speeding up your shutter speed faster, whereas ND filters go beyond that, losing light by actually blocking physical light coming before it even hits the front of the lens, manipulated by shutter speed and aperture. So, you know, we often use an ND filter, for example, to force a really slow shutter speed. You still have to get rid of that light physically. EV is not getting rid of it physically. It's simply telling the camera to do something to try to reduce the exposure below what the meter suggests. What you'll end up with is just a really underexposed image, and you really want the light. You don't want to give up the light. So I hope that makes sense. I hope that helps. It really depends on what mode you're in, and EV is not doing anything magical. It's not doing anything digital. It's just manipulating what you can manipulate yourself manually.
Yep. Good answer. I have nothing to add.
All right. Well, that's good because this next one is primarily for you, Jordan. This is another speak pipe from Cameron DeHaan.
This question is primarily for Jordan. And I know this question is outside of your normal wheelhouse, but I was wondering if you would be interested in doing a step-by-step process or a beginning-to-end process on how to take videos and edit them into like a YouTube video. I just recently got back from a 350-mile backpacking trip, and I'm currently editing all those videos. And I'm running into a lot of issues when it comes to like storage or organization or even how to color grade properly. So I was wondering if you would be interested in doing something like that. I know I would appreciate it. I know I'm kind of a small niche, but I would really appreciate it. So thank you guys so much for all your work. Guten Tag.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tricky one because I could certainly show you my workflow, but the workflow for making YouTube videos where you know very specifically what you need and don't need is completely different from going on a trip, collecting a bunch of footage and video, and then trying to assemble it into a story later. That's something I have been able to do, like Idaho was certainly that way. But it's not something that I do a lot of the time. And it's so dependent on your workflow. Like, you know, I could do it on Final Cut or I could do it on DaVinci, and I would never do it on Premiere because I don't like Premiere very much. But if anybody outside of those, it's not going to be that useful for them. And if they're not making YouTube videos as well. So that's the main reason. I mean, I don't think it would be that useful for a lot of people. I can certainly say like there's a ton of good editing tutorials out there. And what I would keep an eye out for is most of them are like, here's how to use editing software. But I would actually look for like, you know, techniques in organizing, storytelling, things like that. Like, you know, the techniques that have been used for 100 years when you're editing, as opposed to how to use this particular piece of software. Mm-hmm. That I find can really help you around like, you know, how do I keep this story creative or engaging? How should we cross cut? Things like that. So I don't think I'm the person to do that. But there is definitely information out there.
Cool. All right. Last one is one more speak pipe. This one is from Andrew.
Hello. This past summer, I replaced my Canon 60D with a R7, and I really love it. My problem now is that I'm running out of storage space on my computer because taking photos at 15 or 30 frames per second and also 4K video takes up a lot of space. So I was wondering if you had any recommendations for a robust, reliable external storage solution for photos and videos that would work with Lightroom and Mac OS X. Thank you.
I think this is a Jaron one because you've gone through a lot of the like SSD. Are you using like a RAID or something for long-term storage?
Jaron? Not anymore. I used to use RAID arrays, so I had a C6 big, and I had a G Technologies Studio something or other. It was like a 4-bay. I have like an 8-bay as well that I don't use anymore. This like the big travel one with the handle on it, which never travels. It just sits on a desk. It just looks cool. But I have switched to SSDs in recent years because the pricing has come down. That said, they're still not cheap, but they're good and you can get a bunch of storage for them. So there's a couple that I'm working on right now. I have one that's from OWC that is it's a RAID array. It's just on some of my other testing bench over there. That works great. I don't love OWC's software, but the hardware is nice. But the one that I've been daily driving now for like 2 years, and I did a review on a Petapixel, is from Sovereign. And it is it's like a dual drive / bunch of ports in it too. So it's not just a drive. You can put other things. It's like dockish. It's Thunderbolt, and it has 2 8-terabyte SSDs into it, which you can raid if you're a madman, but you don't need to because you're running Thunderbolt on an SSD. You don't need anything faster than that. And it's been working great. I use one of them actively, one of the SSDs for whatever I'm actively on, and then another one is for stuff that I still want easy access to but don't have immediate needs for. After that, I move them onto a separate drive, and they go into a Pelican, and I never see them again, which is the opposite of what you guys do, which is you just delete the stuff when you don't need it anymore.
Yeah, we're ruthless.
I know.
You have to be ruthless.
I have masters of every episode that I do hang on to. It's working files that I delete.
I'm probably going to do
that. Period at the camera store where I was running those on a Drobo, and then, you know, 2 years in, realized, like, I've gone back to these once for a blooper reel, and it wasn't even a good blooper reel. Why, this is a waste of my time. So since then, yes, I just archived the final product.
I will say I don't store anything other than wallpapers from, like, my design on my computer itself. Like, this studio has nothing on it. The SSD is just programs. And I switched to that method years ago because I found that it kept my computers running like new for longer. The more stuff you stick on them that they have to boot up every time you fire up the computer, the slower that process becomes. So I do like having stuff on separate drives.
I like to use my main drives. My main drives. Yeah, depending. I do. And because then it makes my desktop look really messy, and I like doing that too.
Oh, just leaving stuff on the desktop?
Yeah.
Okay, I've gotten to the point where I don't even allow my computer to show anything on the desktop anymore.
Oh, like it hides we're so different.
Everything. I can't store anything there if I can't see it. So there you go.
Hey, did you guys know that the best set design from 1966 was for Daibo Satsutoge? Maybe I'm biased because my grandpa did it, but it's fantastic. It's beautiful. The snow scenes, every scene looks like a Hiroshige woodcut print. Anyway,
I don't know where this comes from. You had a chance to mention this earlier.
Yeah, best set design.
Okay.
What's the English name of that movie, Chris?
Sword of Doom.
Oh, okay. Sword of Doom's great. Watch Sword of Doom.
Beautiful.
For anyone just
big
listening.
Big ups to Chris's grandpa.
Every Chris frame of painting.
Wearing a t-shirt for this movie. Right. I don't know why he said that now. We're going to move on to never read the comic.
Cardi can't dance.
The last section.
I want to mention this. So never read the comments. Cardi can't dance. Jordan, why did you break the embargo on the super secret Panasonic G92X? How could you do that? What a crazy mistake to make.
I didn't check when that video, usually as soon as a video is published, I'm like on it to make sure, you know, we didn't screw something up or whatever. I was away from the computer for a little while and I came back to hundreds, it feels like, of what is this G92X? And I mean, it would make sense for them to do like another version of that camera, a more video centric one, but no, that doesn't exist. It was an S5 2X. I made a typo. I later pinned a comment saying as much, but it is having no effect. And my phone is just full of comments of people saying, tell us more about this G92X.
Now Panasonic's furious
at us. It doesn't exist. I'm a dumb dummy. I have been rightly shamed by all of you. Yeah. Just stop. Look at anytime you're going to post a comment like that, see if dozens of other people have already made the same comment, shaming your favorite creators because they're probably really burned out on reading it all the time.
So that camera doesn't exist. Cardi can't dance. Don't worry about it. Looking you dead into the windows of your soul. We're not just messing with you. That camera doesn't exist.
No, it's not a thing.
All right.
Stop. Please, for the love of God.
Absolutely Everything says, I know it's like 3 centuries too late, but I'd love to hear your opinions on the Lumix 24-105 and maybe how it compares to the new 28-200 in photos and videos.
Oh, man. It's been 3 centuries. I can't even remember it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Optically, it's better than the 28-200. I mean, that's not hard to do. So definitely a better choice if you want a faster aperture and better performance throughout the range.
Yeah, and the price difference isn't that dramatic. So unless you absolutely need that 200 millimeters or you're really worried about like keeping things balanced well on a gimbal, those are the two areas where that 28-200 really excel. The 24-105 is a sharper lens. The focus motor on it's great. It's still breathing corrected like most of the Panasonic lenses. The only thing I will say, close-up performance isn't great on it. You definitely do see sharpness fall off a little bit. That's why I don't use it as a B-roll lens. But for regular shooting, I'm very impressed with that. I think it's a great little standard zoom.
Some unremarkable guy says, bring good back name. Unsung cameras of the year.
Well, then why are we even talking to this person? You know, this, so not to be a cynic, but I'm going to say something very cynical here, because like we love making those episodes.
They're great.
The cynical part is they don't get views. And it's not that we're trying to make, I mean, we work for a platform now where we're more concerned about our editor-in-chief, who happens to be right here, and he's a great guy, and he's very intelligent, and loves photography deep down.
Oh, God, where's this going?
Is really more interested in telling stories that maybe it's not about views. It's about, like, this is why we do this. So I really respect that. So we certainly could do that more on this channel. But cynically, they don't get a lot of views. That sucks. It kind of goes to the same thing with Jordan doing a tutorial on his grading. Like, it would absolutely be very interesting, very compelling. It's just such a small audience will appreciate it. And so it becomes tough when we have so much gear to still review and projects that we have to get done. But I wouldn't say it won't come back. It very well could, but it's tough to do on a regular basis, as much as we would love to.
Yeah, I would love to jump back on that. We did one of those for DP Review, which, like Chris mentioned, really underperformed, the Panasonic G1 we went and looked back at.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are some of my – the Nikon F4 is one of my favorite episodes. The Kodak DCS that we got working again, that was a super fun episode. Yeah. Where we got to network with a CF card. It was great. Love those.
So it's not dead.
The Fujifilm S5, where my kid took his first steps to Chris, not to me, that was captured on a video. I mean, yes, it's a great series. I should just put a link to some of those classic ones.
Yeah.
But I would love to do it again. It's tough to justify when there's always new gear coming out and we want to try experimenting with new formats.
ASAP might not be as quick as you're hoping.
Yeah.
All right. The last one is from Peanut Trolls. And they have said...
The names are on fire this week.
maybe a fun question to answer. What's, for each of you, your favorite, quote, bad lens? A lens for videography that breathes terribly, an incredibly flawed photographic lens, an oddball eccentric lens that is for a mount that may not be used anymore, etc. I'll go first because I brought mine.
Oh,
nice.
Dang.
Show and tell.
Yeah. So I actually have two. The first one is this. This is a Nikkor S... 1.4 50 millimeter lens for my
what a piece of garbage that lens was.
So the reason I brought it is because this lens doesn't necessarily resolve well anymore, but
especially at 1.4 it was always garbage right out of the box.
Okay. And the other one that I brought,
it wasn't very sharp.
I really, really love this lens. This one is sharp, is the 105 millimeter f2.5.
Oh, classic. Oh,
that's not a bad lens. That's a great lens.
This is, I brought it because it was right next to this other lens. I'm like, I actually like this one quite a bit. And I know it's not a bad lens, but I still love this lens. I have like an EF adapter on here from when I will use it still.
I wonder if I have my lens around. Should I go run and grab it?
Go for it.
Yeah, while Jordan talks?
Yeah, Jordan can go.
Because he doesn't care what I have to say anyways, so this works out perfectly.
He's still got his earbuds in. He can hear you.
I can still hear you.
I'm going to leave that in. I hope that comes through on the audio. Oh,
it'll cut through, no problem. That 105 is one of my favorite video portrait lenses.
Right? This is beautiful. For a close-up.
Oh, my. It's great. Yeah. My worst is, by all metrics, one of the worst lenses we ever tested was the Laowa 35mm f.95. Yeah. But man, did I love the images that thing created. It felt like an old-timey, like an 8x10 camera from like 1876, the photos that came off of it. Super fun for video as well. But that's one of my favorite sample galleries we did back on DP Review. I think, you know, they were like, give us like 30 images. And I think I dropped like 120 shots on that gallery because I was just having so much fun shooting it. That is a really fun lens.
So it's objectively one bad, it's fun.
Yeah, it's bad. You know,
actually, for video,
it's CA everywhere. Gorgeous. The weirdest flare. It's like big crescents with weird globs in them that would globs. Be all over your frame. And there were globs, Jared.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes like concentric rainbow rings and stuff. I mean, I'd say that about a lot of Laowas is like they're interesting lenses, but often the optical corrections are so bad that they're good. And that'd be high up for me, too. Okay, so I did run. So I had a real soft spot for classic lenses, telephotos, telephoto zooms. This is an Nikkor 70-150 Series E, f3.5 all the way through. Everybody had one. They're not great. I also really like, they're so bad, Jaron ran away. He was so offended. Also, the Vivitar Series 1 70-210s, those are also again, objectively not great, but I have a soft spot for them. I really liked
them. Yes, Jaron.
Yeah. So yeah,
I had to go grab mine. This is, look, I don't think it's the same lens. But
look at this cap keeper. The elastic is not even elastic anymore. Yeah.
I can't actually even tell what this is.
But yeah, but like have, old school zooms, I think they were terrible. Like here's a Tokina. This is kind of a it's rare one. Labeled. This is a Tokina 28-70, 28-4.3. Look at that.
4.3. Chris, what was the lens that you just good brought? Aperture. It looked really familiar, but I don't think it's the same.
Yeah,
as mine.
It's a 70-150 Series E f3.5. Series E was like their economical series, but I liked it because it was lightweight. You know, push pull zoom, nice and quick, and f3.5 was decently fast. Although you do not want to shoot this lens at f3.5 very often. Like you know, Shahaf was talking about, you know, how lenses have to be designed now. You like, why can't we make them all perfect? Back in this era is when lenses really had so much correction required, and you really had to give and take and choose. If I correct CA, the sharpness is going to be terrible. If I make the lens sharp, it's not going to be good wide open. Like it was a really challenging time. And that was like, maybe arguably
you
more
want
interesting.
It to zoom, it's going to be bad then.
Bad. Yeah. But that was an interesting time because that's really where manufacturers had to like really make some hard decisions about what to keep and what to lose in a lens, working within budgets. Like it was a very sort of interesting dynamic environment.
I think this is a 200 f4. I thought it was a zoom, but it's not. But it's just that's
actually a
focus.
Decent lens.
Yeah. I will say the last narrative that I worked on, A Walk Down to Water, was largely shot with Chris's old AI Nikkors because we wanted a very vintage look to it. So we had a nice set of Sony CineAlta for like a very clean, very little character look for some of the shots, but when we wanted to get a little bit more interior, we switched over to the Nikons, and I love the look of those. So
there you go.
All right, thanks guys,
we got through. That's it, boys, do it.
Thanks for listening in. We look forward to hearing your thoughts on what Chris and Jordan picked for their favorite movies, and thanks again to OM System for sponsoring this episode. We will see you guys all next week when we will actually have a guest. Those of you who made it this far are like, so where's the guest who heard me last week? Yeah, no, there is no guest. I got the schedule wrong. After we hit the stop recording button, Jordan's like, there's no guest next week. It's like, oh.
Huge guest. Interesting conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, look forward to it. We've got a couple in the next couple weeks. So yeah, we'll see you then. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.